Okay, we're now ready for another wonderful presentation. I have become by default the introducer. So I'm not the decider, but the introducer. Our next presenter may need no introduction for... Our next presenter, better? May need no introduction for most of you, but Suzanne Humphreys is a medical doctor, a nephrologist by training. And there came a point in her career that she recognized that there was something going on with vaccines. She has published, lectured around the world, associated with many organizations that are advancing the rights and interests of persons who are vaccine injured. She has a wealth of information and insight, groundbreaking in many cases. So without further elaboration, let's welcome again Suzanne Humphreys.
You can keep that one. I have this one.
Just a quick announcement, unless you're authorized, please do not record the presentations. Thank you.
Okay, can everybody hear me all right?
Yes.
Good. Had a little trouble with the lapel mic, so let me know. Before I even start, well, first of all, thank you. And thank you, Terry and Ed, for this great conference that you put together in this really interesting city. I just want to say that I am not the sole author of Dissolving Illusions, and there was a co-author named Roman Bistrianic, who without him, this book would not exist. Between the two of us, there are about 20 years of research in this book. I sometimes look at it and I think if I knew beforehand what this book was going to require, I would have never written it. And Roman did a lot of the work, and I wish he was here today because he deserves as much of your applause and love as I do, if not more. So anyway, this talk is going to be at least an hour, so I'm just letting you be prepared for that. Hope your bladders are all empty. I am a nephrologist after all. Okay, so my journey into illusions actually started in 2009 when my patients began having kidney failure. So I didn't start in the realm of autism. I didn't come to the realm of autism until very recently. And so in the beginning, my first patient says to me, I asked my patient, why are you here? Which dialysis unit did you come from? And he said, what are you talking about? I've never been on dialysis before. I never had kidney problems before that shot. And that was the beginning for me. I said, what shot? And from there on in, the amount of resistance and what about smallpox, what about polio that came at me actually turned me into the library, into the books, to start doing research because I knew this guy was right. And during that time, I found problems in my patients who had chronic kidney disease with worsening after vaccination. And I found that if you ask a simple question to all patients, which should be part of every doctor's history and physical examination, which is, when was your last vaccine, that some very revealing connections can be made. So because I knew nothing of the contents or the history of vaccines, when the problems happened and the backlash toward me occurred in the hospital in 2008 to 2011, I really had nothing to fight back with back then. If I had known then what I'm going to tell you today, I could have easily beaten the arguments that were initially tossed at me. I have to get reacquainted with this thing. Okay. So earlier this year, when I was in the UK, I visited a place called Leicester that I discovered while I was writing Dissolving Illusions with Roman, which for the history buffs amongst you is actually the linchpin of the anti-vaccination movement. The people of Leicester, after years of fighting for their human rights, overturned compulsory vaccination in 1889. Most people here probably think that the smallpox vaccine was invented by Edward Jenner, but it wasn't. What I'm not going to talk much about that today, or the fact that successful, voluntary, very careful inoculation to the wealthy was going on in the Ottoman Empire long before Jenner, or that when that practice was brought to England, the doctors did it all wrong and actually created infectious bedlam. Smallpox vaccines are lauded as being the one great success story of eradication, right? That's totally false, and any slight potential benefit, if it ever existed, was certainly not worth the imprint that this vaccine has left upon humanity. The sum total of smallpox vaccination was a horrific, painful, deadly nightmare for too many recipients. I think that eradication would have occurred even earlier than 1979 if vaccination was stopped earlier. Today, I want to talk to you about why smallpox is so important to understand, even in today's struggle with vaccine religious zealots. And it probably won't be for any reason you will likely have thought of. This building you see behind me is a men's prison today. But in 1871 was the prison where the fathers who refused to vaccinate their babies and couldn't afford their fines were incarcerated to serve out their sentences. In 1871, the town of Leicester had 200,000 people, no sewage, no clean water, putrid drains, and 110% vaccination rate. Nope, you heard that right. Everyone was vaccinated with a few who had extras just for good measure. In the year 1871, one of the most severe epidemics of smallpox on record occurred. During an era of meticulously documented statistics, and it happened following 33 years of official compulsory vaccination. 3,000 cases of smallpox occurred in 1871, and 358 people died. Until that point, even though parents hated the vaccine and were horrified at the side effects and deaths of their children from it, they believed that the disease was worse than the vaccine. 1871 put a stop to that thinking, and Leicester residents began to rise up and say, "We are not going to continue to sacrifice our children to a deadly and disgusting vaccine that doesn't even work." The response to the 1871 epidemic by health officials was to write stricter laws and appoint even more vaccination officers, because like today, the problem is not allowed to be the vaccine. It was the people who just needed more doses of the vaccine. Prosecutions in the town increased from 2 in 1869 to over 1,100 by 1881, the total for the 12 years being over 6,000. Of these, 64 had involved imprisonment and 193 seizures of property to obtain money owed for fines. By 1889, only about 15% of babies in Leicester were vaccinated. And the number of parents in front of the court was so many that this prison could never have held them all. Apart from which, the courts were so badly clogged up that hearing the cases became a legal impossibility. How did that happen? Parents stripped away the blinders the medical and public health systems had put over their eyes and for once believed their hearts. In 1889, 110 districts had effectively annulled compulsory smallpox vaccination because the so-called anti-vaccination movement was a united force to be reckoned with. Over 100 parliamentarians in the House of Commons were anti-vaccine, and there was simply no way the legal system could deal with the parents all over England refusing to be vaccinated. But 1871 was not the start of the so-called anti-vaccination movement. It started very shortly after Edward Jenner came out with his disgusting vaccine made of horse or cow pus, and initially didn't even contain the smallpox virus. Within a few years, parents were totally disillusioned with the whole idea. As seen in this document published in 1817, only 20 years after the cowpox vaccine development, parents were already filled with alarm and fear. Knowing full well the sickness and death that vaccines were causing in their perfectly healthy children. Doctors were also reporting serious illness, sepsis, serious skin disorders, and actual smallpox in their well-vaccinated children. Yet, the Jennerian Committee accused those doctors who dissented and reported problems with the cowpox inoculation of having acting perversely and disingenuously, and misrepresenting cases according to their standard of proof. The Jennerian Committee never factually answered the questions that the anti-vaccine doctors posed. Instead, they sneered and spat venom in the direction of anyone who doubted the vaccination process. This all becomes very obvious when you mine the medical literature of the time. But that's not something that my former colleagues, nor my critics of today, ever bother to do. Instead, they carry on the 200-year-old tradition of bitterness, unfounded accusations, and utter nonsense about vaccine risks and effectiveness. And still today, while their accusations merit no reply, we are the ones who take out the books and the historical records and continue to attempt to drill sense and knowledge into the insane dialogue that we're forced into. The irony is that most of those who spread the sound bites the public believes wouldn't have a clue where to start to research the realities of why the anti-vaccination movement ever even came into being. In a perverse sort of way, it's comforting to know that the honest, open-minded doctors of the past suffered the similar fate as I suffered when seeing vaccine reactions in my own patients and discussed them with the leaders of hospital administration. At the time, I knew no history, so I was totally startled at what seemed to be an absurd response. I thought the administration would want to know that vaccines were causing problems in people and landing them on dialysis or worsening their kidney function. The response I received shocked me to the core. Every time I wanted to talk about the stupidity of giving influenza and pneumococcal vaccines to someone having a heart attack or to a leukemia patient on chemotherapy with new onset kidney failure and a creatinine of 7, or to someone with serious sepsis, it seemed that just about everyone around me responded like programmed automorons. All they could say was, "But smallpox vaccines saved the world." Every time I tried to bring them back to the fact that I was talking about influenza and pneumococcal vaccines today in my own sick patients, they did exactly the same thing. "Now, Suzanne, let's talk about smallpox." And if it wasn't smallpox, a few questions about polio would have done just fine. And if I had said statins or ACE inhibitors or nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory agents were causing kidney problems, my peers in the hospital administration would have said, "Well then, let's stop using those drugs." But vaccines, it was a totally different story that I was unprepared for. If you want to know more about my experience in the medical system, starting actually in 1989, my book Rising from the Dead gives the inside story dating up to 2013. It's an expose, an insider's report in retrospect, after I had woken up and put the pieces together. The dead refers to what I once was and what doctors who are successfully brainwashed and accept all the gold standards become. So let me tell you a story about smallpox that I didn't know, when hospital doctors talked nonsense at me. But I need to start it in mid-2002. One day, a letter landed on my desk. I didn't save it because I had no idea the future significance. The letter was an invitation to be vaccinated against smallpox because first responders and volunteers were getting vaccinated and the hospital needed a front line of doctors to be immune in order to deal with the rogue infections and adverse reactions that those who accepted the vaccine could have. Even though I knew zero about vaccines back then, I just laughed, I crunched up the paper, tossed it in the rubbish bin. My rational brain and instinct kicked in. Vaccinating me so I could protect the vaccinated from the adverse effects of the vaccine. Exactly. No thanks. At the time, I was too busy trying to rescue a group of people who had kidney failure from drinking arsenic-laced coffee that they drank in a church gathering in northern Maine, so I had more acutely pressing issues on my mind. So how did this issue of the need for smallpox vaccines in 2003 come about? The USA decided to invade Iraq in 1991. And then along came September 11th and the assertion of some mythical weapons of mass destruction in the former friend turned enemy, Iraq. So back we went again to invade Iraq. But not content with that load of fear, the CIA thought up something even better than weapons of mass destruction and announced that terrorists had obtained lethal stocks of smallpox to wreck the lives of Americans, and of course, the Russians did it. Supposedly, a previously esteemed dead Russian scientist who couldn't talk back had provided a virulent strain of smallpox to Iraq, who were in the process of weaponizing it. And because the CIA, FBI, and other finders of fact are always reliably, so accurate with their crystal ball gazing, President Bush immediately decided to vaccinate the whole USA to stop everyone being decimated by weapons of smallpox terror spread by Iraqi terrorists. What could be simpler? After all, hadn't the smallpox vaccination once saved the world? Isn't it the only vaccine to have ever eradicated a microbe from humanity? It was safe and effective, right? Anyone who argued against it in the past must have been idiot anti-vaccinators who lacked understanding of settled science. Bush announced a multi-tiered nationwide campaign, starting with hospital doctors and then spreading outwards. The urgency was because today's bad guys were trying to make smallpox even more deadly and resistant to treatment than ever. Time magazine went along with President Bush, enthusiastically printing even more fear and pushing the be a good citizen call to the public. Sanjay Gupta, of course, chimed in, quoting a Robert Wood Johnson survey, which showed that two-thirds of America, quote, seemed to be willing to put their lives at risk for a disease that is entirely theoretical, unquote. One must wonder what type of information was given to the people surveyed. Taking a swipe at those who might not agree, Gupta said, if it's any comfort to procrastinators, the smallpox vaccine will still protect you against the disease after you've been infected, as long as you get your shot within 2 or 3 days. That's assuming you can find one in the middle of a smallpox attack. In case you didn't recognize the while supplies last sales pitch, they never came close to running out, nor would they have. Nor do they when they make the same announcement about influenza vaccines running low. And when it comes to smallpox, after all, arm-to-arm vaccination would always have been an option, right? Besides, with 6 months before, the ACIP had said that vaccine would be in hand for all Americans by the end of 2002. The Washington Post reported Julie Gerberding as stating that such a program would enhance the country's readiness to deal with both terrorist or a naturally occurring emergency. And why not be enthusiastic? The CDC was totally humiliated in 1976 when the naturally occurring emergency of swine flu never showed up. The public was warned that it would be akin to the 1918 flu epidemic, and panic ensued. 45 million people were vaccinated in 4 weeks with the swine flu vaccine. The official toll of people who qualified by government standards as having Guillain-Barré syndrome was more than 200, 11 of whom died. There was a clustering of cases in the second and third weeks after vaccination. The ill-conceived campaign was labeled a fiasco. Only one person died with natural swine flu that year. The CDC and Institute of Medicine today agree that the vaccine led to an increased risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome. So, in 2013, Gerberding was keen to restore the faith with a successful nationwide vaccination campaign, which would again save the world from terrorists and pandemic germs. What a wonderful nation-building exercise, right? It also brings one to mind of the same nation-building exercise the polio vaccine developers used. The public was led to believe that these types of images were caused by polio virus and that the only viable solution was a vaccine. Now, that might seem a little harsh to people who are not familiar with my research and dissolving illusions, but I guarantee you if you read the 60 pages on polio vaccine, you will come to understand that statement. These images were used to instill fear in parents all over the world. If you've read the truth about that era, you know how the public was totally duped into donating to the cause of a vaccine and later maimed by the vaccine they cheered for and paid for. But getting back to 2003, while the public was being refed stories about how wonderful Jenner was, how fabulous the World Health Organization smallpox eradication campaign was, and what a worthy vaccine the smallpox one had been, behind closed doors at the CDC, people were looking closer, and there was a bit of a judder bar. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and the world's most experienced living smallpox doctor, Dr. Thomas Mack, was painting a completely different picture. He vehemently disagreed with the ignorant talking heads and said that even without vaccination, smallpox would have died out anyway, and worse, to vaccinate Americans without immune globulin, which is a specific immune globulin, would be extremely dangerous. To put this in context, though, consider why parents in Leicester had rebelled against vaccination in the 1880s. Quite apart from the fact that the Advisory Committee on Immunization, that this is what was considered a typically well-vaccinated child's arm. Remember that these people lived in overcrowded cities with disgusting water, dreadful drainage, no sewage, no sterile dressings, and where scarlet fever and typhoid were feared a whole lot more than smallpox was feared. Given that all the historical records show how painful and itchy smallpox vaccination sites were, can you think of how parents would stop their children ripping arms open with the pain of such a good arm? But back to Dr. Mack in 2002. He goes on to tell the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices that if you were vaccinated, fatality was low for ordinary smallpox, but the vaccine didn't protect you against the worst kind of smallpox, which begs the question, would it protect against weaponized smallpox? It sounds like it really wouldn't. The whole story is actually ludicrous. He said that to do another worldwide vaccination campaign would result in, note this, immeasurable suffering to tens of thousands. And this is in the day of good sanitation, antibiotics, ability to cover with sterile bandages, painkillers, and all the bells and whistles to supposedly make the patient more comfortable. Consider what vaccinations would have been like in the marginally habitable cesspits of England in the 1880s, in the 1800s. While the public was being called to duty, Dr. Mack told the ACIP why smallpox would never return and that it disappeared due to economic development, not because of vaccines. Wow! That's not what we were brainwashed with in medical school at all. Dr. Mack then pointed out that the public had negligible risk from smallpox introduction and substantial risk from vaccination, and that informed consent would have to state that the risks exceeded the benefits. Most importantly, any reaction that was attributed to a smallpox vaccine would result in other people refusing it. And this is why no vaccine reaction can be publicly admitted to. So who is this Dr. Mack anyway? He's a doctor who spent more time working up population-based outbreaks of smallpox than virtually anybody ever has, with hands-on experience that none of the other talking heads at the CDC and ACIP would have ever experienced. Even so, his knowledge wasn't palatable to the New England Journal of Medicine, who had to print his opinion, but termed it, quote, a different view, unquote. So what does that imply? Those who are awake and step out of the zombie line are always accused of being a small but vocal minority. Mack explained that smallpox wasn't as infectious as the public had been conditioned to think. He said that smallpox was eradicated, quote, because the chain of transmission was vulnerable, unquote. The spread was very limited and it couldn't be spread through the air. Smallpox was transmitted only over short distances, mostly at the bedside, and despite low herd immunity, had disappeared. Quarantine has always worked well. Two really interesting points were that hospitals were the main points of spread, and that complications would be several times as common as previously. How could a modern second-generation vaccine possibly be more dangerous than the vaccine in the 1800s? He also explained that it wasn't just the public being fed lies in the mainstream media, but at an international bioterrorism meeting he attended, where North American and European politicians participated in a theoretical discussion of a potential bioterrorism event, he said they were dished up a load of one of my favorite English terms. Poppycock, poppycock, and more poppycock, in the form of three false lessons. The most experienced smallpox virologist on the earth said a smallpox pandemic is not likely, that ordinary methods of public health would control any outbreak, and that vaccine stores are certainly not the key to control. The public never got to hear that they were all told poppycock either. Back in 2002, some studies done on vaccinating the fittest, creme de la creme, most super healthy university students without one health blemish left researchers stunned at the degree of severity of reactions of today's supposedly better smallpox vaccines. While Fauci tried to explain it away as something that would have been tolerated or ignored in the past, Walter Orenstein, the vaccination great, who who had witnessed very nasty vaccine reactions in recipients with red streaks running up the arm, really bad takes, and running for the antibiotics, and that vaccinated people required lots of tender, loving care. He said to Connolly, "I respect this vaccine." In other words, the parents in the 1800s were right. This vaccine could and definitely would cause problems. This view was backed by the editor of the New York Times, Michael Pollack, who told how he had nearly died from brain encephalitis from the 1947 smallpox vaccine he was given at 6 months of age. He was writing in the first of the newspapers to admit that even if they only gave the modern smallpox to two-thirds of Americans, the healthiest people, there would be 285 deaths and 4,600 serious side effects. Okay, so do you remember the letter that I was given in 2002? To show you that it was all very real in 2002 and 2003, I found this Illinois state information package sent to Illinois doctors who did say yes to the vaccine in 2003. And here was their 63-page follow-up package that gave a wonderful informed consent, and among other things, suggested that everyone err on the side of caution and not put your loved ones at risk of a serious adverse reaction. Had I said yes, I would have been asked to join with the CDC head, Julie Gerberding, to be vaccinated against smallpox. Note that the letter says, "This is a decision that must be weighed carefully." The 63-page dossier said that supposedly new side effects were being seen, including myopericarditis, pericarditis, and that's all inflammation around the heart or in the heart muscle, angina, and heart attacks. In that packet were two long lists of potentially fatal and very debilitating side effects. While the first response target was 500,000, by the end of 2004, less than 40,000 people had volunteered. And it's little wonder. Doctors were informed that if they had a known heart issue, they shouldn't have the vaccine. And anything to do with blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, or a relative with such was also a relative contraindication. The information in this package constituted highly detailed informed consents with more out clauses than an anthill. If I had volunteered for the smallpox vaccine in 2002, I would have been given this type of detailed information. Yet, this is a particularly nasty vaccine. We all know that. But consider what would happen in a hospital if one-third of the doctors who got this vaccine became sick enough to need time off. The system would have been very stressed. Yet this was not considered a problem when making babies very ill during the times when smallpox was supposedly being eradicated by vaccines. Also consider what babies in the 1800s had to deal with environmentally. 12 years later, in 2015, we are also told that after the smallpox vaccine, new onset chest pain, dyspnea, and heart palpitations occurred frequently, and myocarditis, pericarditis, was 200 times higher than the background population rate. Subclinical myocarditis, evaluated by checking cardiac enzyme levels in the blood, was 60 times higher than the incidence rate of overt clinical cases. The better modern vaccine wasn't really looking that good at all by now. In another 2016 study, Dr. Voigt showed the carditis rates for smallpox vaccine recipients to be 7.4 times higher than the unvaccinated. Dr. Voigt intoned, "We don't know why this happens." If they don't know why in 2016, do you think that doctors in 1850 would have diagnosed it or known why it happened? Did doctors then know how to diagnose all these heart conditions after the old vaccine? How many babies' hearts stopped after the vaccine, and the parents had the link dismissed as coincidence? You shouldn't be surprised by anything that I'm saying now if you know about this study done by Del Campo in 1967, which I pull out fairly frequently. But don't hold your breath for this to be repeated anytime soon. Remember that back in 1967, when this was published, the vaccination program was a fraction of what it is now. And hopefully the vaccines were slightly higher purity than the old smallpox vaccines. This is an article in English which summarized 12 Italian articles which published in-depth analyses on 200 children 5 years of age and older when the immune system was more developed. This is how the body attempts to adapt to the trauma of bacterial, viral, adjuvant, chemical, and toxoid loads in the new, better vaccines. But getting back to smallpox, if in 2003 they were avoiding the 33% of weak Americans and still expecting 4,600 serious side effects and 285 deaths in the selected healthy vaccinees based on analyses of the supposedly new, safe, and wonderful smallpox vaccine given to the creme de la creme healthy recipients, what do you suppose the death and serious reactions would have been back in the centuries before, when everyone, young and old, was vaccinated without consideration of any health condition and no care was taken after vaccination? We know that after thousands upon thousands of vaccinated people got smallpox, and thousands died anyway during the English epidemic in 1871, at a time when the UK had near total vaccination, according to the records, that the general population in over 110 districts in England rebelled against compulsory vaccination. They saw that during the epidemic, the vaccine didn't work. They realized that the maiming and deaths of their children every year wasn't worth the price because the benefits were not more than the risks. En masse, parents who witnessed the devastation to their own children became anti-vaccinationists. They were not illiterate, lunatic fringe with low IQ and limited cognitive complexity and thinking patterns, as alleged by today's vaccine high priest toward anyone who doesn't bow at the altar of vaccination. In fact, the people in this audience here today probably have higher cognitive complexity than the average doctor today who is pushing vaccines. Because I can tell you personally, as someone who's gone through the medical education process, that going through the process successfully does not require cognitive complexity. But it does require some things. It requires diligence, it requires hard work, and it requires the ability to be a good follower. Parents in the 1800s knew that their babies and children were maimed and died after vaccines. They once thought the vaccines were worth the price, just like many of you in the audience. When they saw it wasn't, they stopped vaccinating. They knew that not only were children dying, but the adults who were revaccinated frequently nearly died. Consider this account from a man called Edwin Cox, who was successfully vaccinated as a child. He was pro-vaccine and enthusiastically agreed to be revaccinated as an adult in 1868, the result of which turned him into an anti-vaccinationist. This is just one of many stories in old literature, and it's also what we see today all over the world. These stories are told by pro-vaccine people who were vaccinated and suffered like this. And when we as doctors report vaccine reactions or even try to ask vaccine questions today, we are treated like criminals. The result is that doctors do one of two things. They do as they're told and shut up and never report it, or they leave their mainstream jobs. I'm constantly having to remind the vaccine zealots that all the names written on this bus, whether as a result of Gardasil, the flu vaccine, DPT, or MMR, are there because pro-vaccine parents vaccinated their children, and all these correlational deaths and disabilities followed the vaccines. Just like in 1817, parents 200 years later, in 2017, are met with bitterness of invective and unhandsome sneers. And the doctors, if they report all suspected links, like I did, or have the audacity to publicly doubt any vaccine, are treated as if they are acting perversely and disingenuously. The reason the smallpox vaccination campaign of the whole of the USA never took place in 2003 was because the vaccine priests were very scared of a situation just like this. All these names on the bus that could have been made public and cast doubt on the vaccination programs. Even in 2002, medical planners were starting to backpedal, with the odd doctor describing the directive as overheated hysteria. The CDC was in a real bind here. They couldn't tell the public the truth because 200 years of medical history had carefully cultured the myth that smallpox vaccines were safe enough and effective enough to have eradicated a disease from the face of the earth and rarely, if ever, harmed people. They had brainwashed society to believe that the anti-vaccination movement back then was a load of hot air, made up of hysterical, naturalist tree huggers who couldn't grasp the miracles of modern medicine. Paul Offit still cracks on people of the past who doubted the harms of the smallpox vaccines. I heard him do it when I was sitting in his NYU Medical School Hall lecture last year. I also heard him crack on all of you parents of people with autism when he said, quote, "The real problem here is that parents of children with autism just don't understand that vaccines don't prevent autism," unquote. In 2002, the CDC was confronted with their own doctors reminding them that the smallpox vaccine had never eradicated the disease, nor was it effective, especially against the worst kind of smallpox. Even worse, it was not safe, even if they gave it to only the healthy people. And the reality is that if a weaponized version of smallpox had been released, it would have been the worst kind of smallpox, not the garden snail variety, and no vaccine would have touched it. So as a diversionary tactic, they argued about the validity of the intelligence information. Shh, let's not talk about the vaccine. But someone was scared, really scared. They had crunched the numbers and realized that if 500,000 first responder medical doctors were vaccinated and they keeled over in large numbers, then the whole population might suddenly realize that they had been lied to about how wonderful the smallpox vaccine was and is, and that the past 200 years of lies could no longer be used as ammo against those of us who see real issues today after today's supposedly wonderful clean vaccines. And the reality that Del Campo described here and all of today's reports from secondary non-vaccinators would set fire to the sparks that are already burning. Their greater fear then became that huge numbers of vaccine reactions in healthy people would sour the public on vaccines in general. When the doctors were asked why they were scared, they only said one word, experience. What experience? They didn't elaborate. So I'll take you backwards and look at some of that experience they would not share with the larger public. Dr. Dworetsky told them in 2002 about what happened when well-vaccinated military troops in the 1940s came down with smallpox disease. Many of them died. Many had such painful smallpox that morphine only marginally relieved their anguish. Everyone was surprised. Shouldn't the vaccine have stopped that? Then he talked about the terrible reactions when the hospital staff members were revaccinated. Why? Because the vaccine was contaminated. Maybe he was surprised, but if he had looked back to the Lancet articles mentioned in a published talk by Dr. Beto Bailey, written a decade after the World War II soldiers fell ill, he would have known that he was not alone in the 1940s. The Lancet described in November 1944 100 consecutive smallpox cases in another military hospital in people who had been vaccinated more than enough times. Does this vaccine work? Dr. Beto Bailey also discussed how badly contaminated the smallpox lymph was and why it caused so many nasty reactions. From the many pathogens which were passengers in the smallpox vaccines. Because this vaccine was so bad, the very group which had been the core of those who by law must be vaccinated in the 1800s, the children and those under 18 years, were suddenly not allowed to be vaccinated in 2002 because they could tear off their bandages and put relatives and playmates at risk. In the social conditions we described in Dissolving Illusions, when there was no sanitation, no antibiotics, no sterile dressings, no medical exemptions, no nothing, what do you think children did then with bandages? Were they changed regularly? Were the old ones burned? Did everyone sterilize their hands effectively with soap? Picture the scene in your mind. In the end, the CDC just dropped the whole idea, and a silent pond called Ask No Questions, Get Told No Lies. I remember just hoping it would all go away after I tossed my invitation to be vaccinated into the trash in 2002. Fortunately, that's exactly what happened. A blanket media silence descended on President Bush's vaunted program because the decision makers knew that the smallpox vaccine was simply too dangerous and could cast doubt on both the historic rhetoric and the accepted and lucrative vaccine programs of today. It should now be obvious that parents rebelled in the USA and the UK between the 1800s and the 1940s, not because they were stupid anti-vaccine idiots with no brains, but because they knew and experienced the fact that smallpox vaccination maimed and killed their babies, and the medical profession refused to admit it. Only the rich could afford nice headstones like this, but every country in the world from 1800 onwards had an anti-vaccine movement. Even in India, in Ceylon, in African countries, everywhere the old vaccine went, outraged parents followed, and they were ignored, and people were rounded up at gunpoint and forcibly vaccinated. Yet today, I'm constantly asked, what about smallpox? When I criticize any vaccine. Today, Polly and I are constantly barraged by the most insanely arrogant accusations that we are going to bring back smallpox because we are exposing the truth about today's vaccines. So vaccination came to an end in the USA, but not quite, because of yet another crazy practice, which was exposed by Dr. Bebani, whose vaccinated older brother died of smallpox. He tells the story of why it took so long for the smallpox vaccine to be removed from use. We know that drug companies are always trying to find uses for orphan drugs because they hate drugs not earning them money. A drug taken off the market is always a tragedy to them. Smallpox vaccination was supposed to be discontinued in 1971, but it continued because the manufacturers convinced doctors that it could be used as a treatment for warts and herpes. So in 1978, 4.4 million doses of smallpox vaccines were used, even though the result could be death. It was finally stopped in the 1980s, but only after a seven-month-old baby died following a smallpox vaccine to treat 3 months of recurrent herpes simplex mouth ulcers. And the vaccine zealots say, I'm a dangerous loon. Well, if the smallpox vaccines of today made the CDC planners in 2003 shudder and quietly decide to stop a vaccination campaign and toss out all the vaccine which was ready for every American at the end of 2002, and then in 2008, after more than 100 years of use, the Centers for Disease Control called for quarantine and destruction of all remaining Dryvax vaccine. What were they trying to hide? The vaccine religious and the brainwashed automatons that pop up wherever the truth about vaccines is being told think that contaminated cowpox, horse grease, and mutant hybrids, quasi-species strains of vaccinia jabs wiped out smallpox from the earth. They brush off mountains of evidence and instead choose to religiously believe in all vaccines. They think that written and spoken words from the hundreds of thousands of parents and politicians who effectively squashed compulsory vaccination in 1889 were just a load of hysterical rubbish. Parents today should know that overturning of compulsory vaccination in 1889 came about because parents of vaccine-damaged children had simply had enough. They got brave, they spoke up, and voted out pro-vaccine politicians in local and governmental elections. Their revolution against compulsory vaccination succeeded in an era with no internet, no cars, no radio, no TV, when people worked 12-hour days, sometimes 7 days per week. There were no nightclubs or coffee clubs where young parents gathered to talk about their children's health. There were no conferences like this. Those conversations happened in passing on the occasional trips into town. In Leicester, England, millions of people, remembering the names and memories of thousands of maimed and dead babies, came together in agreement, and over 100 politicians in the House of Commons supported the right of parents to a conscientious objection to vaccination. At the time, there were hundreds of doctors and lawyers speaking out against smallpox vaccination, both in the USA and England, like this doctor, Charles Creighton, a staunch pro-vaccine advocate. He was an eminent medical man who had written countless articles for the Encyclopedia Britannica, and he was asked to write the section on smallpox vaccination. The information available to Dr. Creighton to write the smallpox section was so ambiguous that he was forced to dig up the original data himself, leading to an extensive review of the available scientific literature. His conclusion was that the Jennerian vaccine was of no use at all and would not prevent smallpox. I guess they picked the wrong guy to write that chapter. Even though Dr. Creighton was blacklisted and ostracized by his profession, his presence in London from 1881 to 1918 kept the medical inquisition at bay and probably resulted in the saving of thousands of lives. He lived out his later years alone, but I hope content in the fact that he had the courage to tell the truth no matter how awkward it was for him. Another prominent medical man was Dr. Cruikshank. Sir James Paget directed Dr. Edward Cruikshank to Creighton's work, and Cruikshank got so angry that he swore to expose him as a fraud. Instead, his resulting research was published in a 610-page book in 1889, which totally agreed with Creighton. His work was also dropped into oblivion by the medical profession. So, why do the vaccine religious say that doctors like me will bring back smallpox? Why don't they ever stop and consider what those of us who have taken the time to research have to say? Why don't they ever ask themselves what they might not have ever been taught about smallpox and history? I talk about the reasons why in part 4 of my YouTube video called Honesty Versus Policy, where several trailblazers and minority outliers who had the courage to step out and do the right thing are remembered. One of them is Sir Graham Wilson, an author and highly regarded medical doctor. He wrote a book called The Hazards of Immunization, and he went into detail about the fact that he would never have been able to write the book without the former director of a vaccine company, Burroughs Wellcome, who gave him a mass of records on various vaccine disasters on his deathbed when he had nothing to lose. Sir Graham Wilson said that these disasters were never discussed publicly or in any medical school. And this is why. He says, for fear of compensation claims or of giving a weapon to the anti-vaccinationists. And because they were rarely discussed or printed, most doctors grew up not knowing that history was littered with more than just smallpox vaccine disasters, which had long concerned the thinking doctors of the past. So, because of a long history of ignoring the ugly reality of vaccines, this policy of denial continues into our lifetimes. The FDA states that no doubts can be allowed to exist, whether or not well-founded, about the safety of vaccines because of the need to assure that all vaccines will be used to the maximum extent possible. And this is also why no fully vaccinated, never vaccinated study is easily published in any high-impact mainstream medical journal, and why we're eternally grateful for the one that just came out by Dr. Mawson. To the maximum extent possible, the public must be kept in the dark. The brainwashing in medical school leads doctors to ignore the truth, ignore the real science, the historical and academic evidence of the so-called anti-vaccinationists, making doctors incapable of giving informed consent or telling the truth to parents, or, fortunately, even debating educated parents like yourselves. As many of you here already know, doctors are highly conditioned to always believe and say that vaccine reactions are a coincidence. They believe the drivel that comes out of Paul Offit, like this: that aluminum is considered to be an essential metal with quantities fluctuating naturally during normal cellular activity. It is found in all tissues and is also believed to play an important role in the development of a healthy fetus. And this commonly accepted fallacy by Offit: autism is not an immune-mediated disease. Unlike autoimmune diseases such as multiple sclerosis, there is no evidence of immune activation or inflammatory lesions in the CNS of people with autism. Despite the overwhelming evidence to the contrary found in human cadavers, as Vargas 2005 showed, and in living, breathing people with autism that are noted on the bottom, those colored areas are the inflammatory lesions that Paul Offit says don't exist. Evidence for brain inflammation is overwhelming. I believe that the overwhelming evidence is exactly why doctors are told to never give parents the vaccine data sheet that comes with every vaccine. And by default, doctors who push vaccines have never read them either. They just perform according to the accepted norms, collect their paychecks, and carry on being good little doggies and listening to the high priests like Robert Jacobson of Mayo Clinic, who explicitly tells them not to give out information to parents, but instead to persuade them instead of informing them, and even gave a tutorial on how to do so. The sources that doctors are supposed to know in order to counsel patients are nothing like what you heard here today. They are directed to the minimalist information on the CDC's website that I have personally found to be backed by little or no scientific evidence. The type of informed consent given out to Illinois doctors in 2003 for smallpox candidates is exactly what should be given to all parents considering voluntary vaccination. But we all know that that would instill too much doubt, and any doubts, whether or not well-founded, are not allowed to exist. Those of you who have watched my YouTube presentations, in particular one called Vaccines Forever and another called Manufactured Consent, will know my level of frustration at the never-ending increasing numbers of vaccines. While we watch more and more vaccines added in, it was of interest to me to come across a fascinating 1938 article on vaccination, which was written by Dr. Charles Cyril Oakell in The Lancet, no less, in 1938. The title alone caught my eye, Grains and Scruples. Sounds like a parable, or even a warning of truth to come. As medical students and doctors, we were never educated about any prominent and respected doctors who totally rubbished the practice of vaccination, who compared it to the realm of bloodletting, calling it out as a faith, a superstition, and charlatanery. And certainly, we were never taught that anyone would want such a religion of vaccination to die a quiet death. Dr. Oakell's impatience can clearly be heard when he wrote that we are relieved that the general public is not curious enough to demand an inquest. It's a poignant sentence, isn't it, when you consider that the CDC let the whole smallpox debacle die a natural death in 2003, relieved that the public wouldn't see and hear an inconvenient truth and therefore demand an inquest. His frustration was also borne by what he saw in his medical practice as a doctor when they first trialed the scarlet fever toxin injection in children, and it was a disaster. He also saw that immunization of the not-so-sturdy children led to great sorrow. Setting all that aside, he went on to make some very astute observations, which are worth sharing with you today. I want to key in on what I think are the most important of all these quotes. So for now, I suggest you just think on these words and try not to read with me. Oakell said that immunization of the masses had been undertaken with almost a religious fervor. The enthusiast rarely stopped to wonder where it would all finish or whether the fulsome promises made to the public in the form of propaganda would ever be honored. Without propaganda, there can, of course, be no large-scale immunization. But how perilous it is to mix up propaganda with scientific fact. If we baldly told the whole truth, it is doubtful whether the public would submit to immunization. Think about that. Because that's exactly why the CDC did not go ahead with the smallpox vaccination program in 2003. Oakell continues saying, when injecting a healthy individual with anything, we are always skating on thin ice. And then skipping down a bit, he says, if you knock them out in an effort to protect them from a disease, there's no knowing they will ever get, comma, there is the devil to pay. Yes, the CDC realized that good and proper about smallpox in 2003. Oakhill resumed saying, accidents and mistakes must inevitably happen, and when they take place, what might have been a highly instructive lesson is usually suppressed or distorted out of recognition. While this was written in 1938, we could date it 2017, because the truth never wears thin. Truth is truth, no matter the age. And many doctors who have looked at Gardasil damage will appreciate this little gem where Oakhill says, quote, to get to the truth of what really went wrong generally calls for the resources of something like a Secret Service, unquote. And he hits the nail on the head when he said that a scapegoat must be found at all costs. And by 2017, we've seen numerous scapegoats. Oakhill also was greatly concerned about another elephant in the room, in the future. And he writes, the gradual extension of immunization to an increasing number of diseases is rapidly bringing us to the stage when we have too much to choose from. Shall I be immunized against smallpox, diphtheria, and typhoid, which he calls a standard selection? Who would have known? Or shall I choose from influenza, he says, by the old method, or the common cold by the old method, and scarlet fever? Now, let's pause a moment here, because some of you might not have realized that in 1938, they had old methods for flu and cold vaccination, and a vaccine against scarlet fever, which, by the way, was taken off the market because it caused so many reactions in the nurses and medical staff who it was trialed on. Few people today know that. But now look, he gives you a newer selection when he asks, shall I be highbrow and fortify myself against psittacosis and tularemia and the fever of Malta, Rift Valley, and Rocky Mountains? Then he says what we all feel here today, quote, it is quite clear that if I don't want to tattoo myself from head to foot with injections or come out in as many rashes as a chameleon, I've got to stop somewhere, unquote. In exasperation, he wonders if we can ever abolish a human disease. He knows that every vaccine goes through its craze stage until the propaganda hoardings await the next new craze. I should have been on that slide the whole time I was talking. And the Sisyphean stone comes back down on top of us, he continues, with a different but even heavier burden. Last but not least, he points out that immunization should be left solely to the individual to decide, not forced by law or public health. But of course, even though he was a high-ranking expert in the field of infectious diseases and worthy of a regular column in Lancet, today Oakhill would be called a loon, a quack, or a conspiracy theorist. Lancet no longer lives up to why it was first started, which was to expose scientific nonsense. Lancet no longer publishes the truth about the downside of vaccines. Neither does PLOS One, nor many other high-impact journals. The list is growing fast. So if anyone tries to tell you that you are a lunatic conspiracy theorist, like Oakhill would have been labeled, know this. If you want vaccination to remain your choice, as Oakhill stated in 1938, and as Lester parents fought for in 1881, your first job is to carefully and fully educate yourself so that you can toss your critics back on their heels and get them to think. There are more Cruikshanks, Creightons, and Oakhills out there. They're coming out of the woodwork in what appears to be a race against time. The question is, will enough parents and medical people stand up and be counted before the minds of more children are damaged? If we want choice, if we want political change, we can't leave it to the few. Everyone must step forward and step up to the plate. All the silent but concerned doctors in hiding need to consider their duty to their patients and what it means to be a good doctor, because it takes more doctors like Oakhill, Cruikshank, Creighton, and today's Dr. Moss, Dr. Fan, and Dr. Franz coming out, facing the pain that rises when we see the truth of what we once didn't know. We've hurt people out of ignorance. The best way to make amends is to speak up now. Some of the most powerful and poignant motivators are those who did things wrong and later left the mold that the system tried to cast. Each one of us who comes out makes it easier for the rest. As for parents, remember that it was the parents of Lester who won the day. Just like then, parents of today are perfectly capable of doing the same. This is the end. I just want to tell people that my table and the Vax table are over at the Pikes Peak room, which is far around to the other side of the building, and we'll be there afterwards to talk to you, take pictures, sign books, what have you. Thank you so much for coming today. Thank you all.